From NBI Studios, this is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Ruff.
Ahoy, friends. Thank you for tuning into Truth and Justice. You are listening to the Friday follow-up for Season 17, Episode 6. This week, Bob went through and broke down the autopsies from the triple homicide scene at the house. This has stirred up a lot of questions, and this week we are sans Janet, but Bob and I are here to try to get them all answered. But before we get into that, do we have any housekeeping?
The only housekeeping is, people have been asking, I've been trying to figure it out. Everybody wants to know if the evidence went out in the West Memphis 3 case. And the answer is, as of today, Wednesday, I don't know. So it seems nobody knows. And understand, so the way this was going to work, the way the court order was worked was that the prosecutor's office had to get it packaged up and sent out by last Friday. The defense didn't need to be a part of that. They were just supposed to do it. Did some checking yesterday and earlier today. And it seems like even the attorneys are like, we don't know. My assumption is that it went out because it was ordered by a judge to go out. Like this was way beyond, you know, like a prosecutor deciding if they want to do something. And again, don't keep in mind, Sonia Haygood is the one who filed the motion to do it. So it's not like she's fighting against this, but also there was an order from a judge. And I don't think that anybody would violate the order. I don't think Sonia Haygood's office or her would just violate that order. So my assumption is it got packaged up and shipped out, and it's either at the lab or on its way to the lab. But I do not have that confirmed. I will post on social media if we get confirmation that it's hit the lab.
Excellent. Well, I sure hope it has.
Yeah, and we may have that before this episode airs, because keep in mind, if you're listening Friday, again, we record these on Wednesday nights. So a lot could change in the next 48 hours before you hear this. With that being said, there was a lot to unpack in this one. What'd you think, Zach?
I think there's a lot of interesting theories in there. I have a big question that I'm going to get to in a minute based on a theory you brought up.
Okay.
In the episode, I've been privy to the 3D models for a few weeks now.
Right.
Quentin absolutely did a phenomenal job. If you haven't looked at those 3D models, you can go to the website, look in the case files. There's videos up there of these 3D models that could allude to these shots being one shot. And it's really telling looking at them. I mean, it's very plausible that those shots could be a through and through of the arm into a face. And
mm-hmm.
It's very plausible, even based on those models, just seeing how someone would react.
Yeah.
If you haven't seen the AMP one, I was looking at the AMP one, and at first, when I first saw it, I was like, well, that doesn't make sense. And then I put my hands up on it anyways, and I was like, oh, that does make sense.
Yeah.
That's what you would do. Like I was feeling,
well, it's
like
one of the things you would do.
It's one of the things you could do. Yes,
we have actually. I don't want to spoil it. We'll get into it, but one of the questions we have mm-hmm. has a good theory that I think is real good chance of being accurate.
Okay,
but there, like some of the conversations were like, well, if you're protecting your face, you would put your palms out, not your palms in.
Mm-hmm.
And like it just depends. Like because you could, for those of you that are on YouTube watching, I think it's just as plausible that somebody does this to cover their face as them doing this, like stop the shot. You know, and if you're just listening. Like either to like put your hands out, palms out, like, hey, stop.
Yeah.
Or your palms in, like covering your face, like you're protecting your face.
Yeah. I mean, that happens a lot. There's something's coming at you. There's a lot of times instead of trying to stop it, you kind of cover.
Right.
I don't know. I think that was really interesting. And I think Quentin did a phenomenal job putting those together.
Yeah. What was cool about it is he took all the way he did it was he took all the dimensions, right? So I gave him like the body height dimensions, where they would be positioned, so on and so forth. The trajectory of the shots, he had all the measurements from the autopsy as well as the photos. Because
mm-hmm.
in the actual autopsy photos, there's like, they're like actually put a rod through.
So you can see the through and through.
The injury. And so he kind of like made lines, you know, I don't know how he does it, like through the trajectory of the two shots, and then manipulated the body to see like what position, is it possible and what position would it be in? Because what we wanted to know is like the only way for this trajectory through the arm to go through the neck is his arm would have to be like in some crazy.
Yeah.
But in both cases, it was in a position where it was like, well, that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. It's very accurate. So I'll just get into it. In the episode, I listened to the episode a couple times to make sure that I was hearing what I heard. In the episode, towards the end of the episode, you're kind of breaking down your theory. And at one point you say, where you're discussing the amount of shots and whether there's a reload. And you said there's something more telling that there was two shooters. And then you go into this evidence that they were possibly smoking crack.
Mm-hmm.
Where do you still lead into two?
I guess I never really did connect that dot, did I?
No, you say it. You say that there's two shooters and this is why I believe this.
Yeah, yeah.
And you go into the theory about them, but you never put together why there has to be two shooters because they were doing this.
I would be careful to say there doesn't have to be.
Okay.
Right? But it was another indicator that, you know, it kind of what I meant was the information about the amount of the drug stuff that we'll be getting into mm-hmm. that I talked about. That was the most revealing thing for me.
Okay.
But also part of that is I think it ties in with the idea of there being two shooters. It in that is because with the cocaine levels in their blood and no metabolites, the window of time for that, like I gave a range, like around 5 minutes, mm-hmm. but realistically from all the different case studies I've been reading and stuff about like how long it takes cocaine to get in your bloodstream, we're talking seconds, like a minute and a half.
Okay.
From the time the first person, whoever that was, you know, ingested, took a hit, inhaled whatever the cocaine until they were all shot, heart stopped. And so my point with that was, if we're looking at that limited that tight of a window of time from the time the shooting starts till the time everybody's dead, I don't think it was another reason for me to not believe there was a pause to reload in the middle of that of a revolver.
Okay. So you're basing it off, you're basing the theory of this off of just strictly the time.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we had all, like I said, I do remember saying the episode, like besides all the things I explained last time, mm-hmm. you know, which is, you know, we talked about everything yeah. from like how long it takes to unload and reload a revolver and all these different things and the movements and who's, you know, all the different reasons why it seems unlikely to me that there would be a pause long enough to reload.
Mm-hmm.
But then when you, but that could always still be like, oh, maybe they were incapacitated. Maybe they were just waiting while they reloaded. But now we know, like in a very, very short period of time, from the time they smoked the cocaine, the shooting started and their heart stopped was so fast that just cuts it takes all those other things into consideration. Then you add that speed into it on top of it. That's that tight window of time. Mm-hmm. And to me, that all but eliminates, in my mind, again, I'm not saying this is fact, but in my mind, that all but eliminates the possibility of a pause to reload a revolver.
Okay. Well, and I'm glad that you kind of are going through and connecting those dots for me, because I wasn't able to see what you were going for in the episode when you said that.
That's a good catch. It's funny. It's the way my brain works.
Mm-hmm.
As you were saying that, I'm literally picturing the script document on my desk as I'm writing.
Yeah.
And as you said, it's like, oh shit, I do remember saying like, let me tell you why this, and then I never
got back to it.
Buttoned it up at the end.
So I'm going to jump into a listener question really quick. Joshua says, if Suzanne was still breathing and alive when first responders showed up, how did the cocaine not metabolize? If there were any metabolites shown in her test, does that mean that they weren't testing for them?
They were testing for them. Okay. It's on the panel. The thing about Suzanne was she was not alive. I briefly mentioned this before. Anybody with medical training, you know, like first response training will know what I'm talking about. But there's something that we've talked about in other cases before as well. There's something called agonal respirations. And what it is after someone is dead, and by dead, I mean their heart's not beating anymore, that there's based on electrical impulses that are like triggering in the brain and within the muscles, you'll get somebody who will breathe. It'll scare the shit out of you. Like I've been on calls working with patients where this has happened, like 5-10 minutes after they were deceased, like completely coded, they were gone. And all of a sudden they'll go, you know, and they'll just be these like breaths. And so that gives the impression that they're alive because they're breathing. And it's not like they're sitting there like breathing normally. And when I say she wasn't dead, it's because I can, from the nature of the injury and how her brain was severed by the bullet and the fact that the cocaine didn't metabolize even, you know, 15 minutes later when the police got there, her heart was not beating anymore. It couldn't have been. And if it was, like, it's possible that there was a quivering or an occasional thump or something of the heart, but not enough to be like processing that through the blood and through the kidneys and liver.
That is really strange and kind of horrifying and interesting. Is that a common occurrence?
It's very common, yeah. But I will tell you, like I said, as a first responder, the first time it happens to you, it's pretty shocking.
I can imagine. That's so imagine horrifying.
You have a 12 lead on somebody, EKG, and it's like gone. There's nothing. It's still running flat. They're gone. And then you're turning around, you're starting to pack stuff up and you're starting to put her in, and all of a sudden you get, and you think that, do we miss up? But you look at the monitor, it's like, they're still not there. Yeah. But yeah, it's called an agonal respiration. And also hopefully for the audio, when you're listening to this audio on Friday, if you heard a pause there, well, Erica will clean up the pause, but I just remembered that our software removes any sound that's not somebody talking. So I just made the sound of a deep breath. That's what you missed.
Okay. The one thing that I don't believe there's any questions about is the idea of the needle marks. And I want to say Suzanne had a couple fresh needle marks that were done by the paramedics.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And then...
At the hospital. Could have been. Well, it said hospital, but it probably was actually the paramedics.
And what would they be trying to do there?
It's pretty much standard procedure. Like if you have a critical patient... Like when I would ride on the ambulance or ride on the first response fire engine, like you show up, you got a critical patient,
mm-hmm.
you know, so what would have happened was from when you read all the reports and the testimonies, it's like, you know, that first arriving officer gets on scene, it comes in, everybody's dead. He sees an agonal respiration, EMS has come behind him and he's like, that one's still breathing. They're still alive. And so, you know, they would come in and one of the first things that they're going to check airway and one of the first things they're going to do is pop an IV in.
Okay.
And they put the IV in because they don't know, because that's what they're going to push drugs through. So they don't know if they're going to push drugs yet. They don't know. They obviously she's bleeding. So they're going to put saline in her to try to get, you know, volume back in her blood. If that's a possibility, it would put epinephrine in for the heart or whatever different drugs they're going to administer. But it's like right away, like one of the first things they're going to do is they're going to put an IV in you, like just get it started. So it's there. But she had the one in the arm, and then she also had one in the neck, like a PICC line. That may have been EMS in the ambulance, or it could have been in the hospital. But I would guess by the time she got to the hospital, they're like, okay, this is...
That she'd already be deceased.
Yeah, like I said, she was already deceased, mm-hmm. but that it was like called it. Because that's the other thing, like the EMS has to get approval. Well, it's different in every state, but in most cases, what I'm familiar with is you need to get approval from medical control to stop working the patient,
mm-hmm.
right? So they'll be, you know, they'll get on scene. It's going to be a load and go. They're going to go, there we got one. Still have agonal respirations, and medical control will say, transport, just get her here. Or they might just say, well, what's the 12 lead look like? What's this look like? Okay, you can go ahead and call it. But we don't know if they actually put like an EKG on or anything, or if it was, again, what we would call a load and go, which is she's critical. She's got gunshot wound to the head. There's agonal respirations. Like, put her in the ambulance and let's go.
Okay.
And we'll figure it out.
So Sue in the chat is also bringing up kind of the next step that I was going to go to is talking about the old needle mark on Angela and the fact that it was covered with a Band-Aid.
Right.
I know that there is nothing there to kind of give an idea of how old this needle mark could be. But I mean, when he says old, could it be from that morning or would it have to be from days past?
Again, this... As you might have heard, I'm not thrilled with the depth that was put into this autopsy,
mm-hmm.
any of these autopsies. Because like the term old,
yeah,
I have no idea what that means.
Well, and that's strange. And Suzanne brings it up too, the idea that there was still a bandage on it. Like right. If it's, how long would you keep a bandage on an quote unquote old?
Well, right. So like she might have gone to the doctor that morning.
Right.
Got a blood draw. They put a Band-Aid on it,
mm-hmm.
and does old mean that, you know, it wasn't after death? Does old just mean that it, you know, it was hours before? I certainly wouldn't think you'd still have a Band-Aid on a needle mark from days before,
yeah,
even a day before, you know. So yeah, I wish I could tell you. And again, so we have the photos we have are the exhibits from trial, and they didn't put, you know, so like we don't have the full set of autopsy photos where I can get a better look at that and say, okay, what are we talking about here? I can only see the ones they put up at trial. And from beginning to end, there was no care from the EMS or from the initial arriving police department or police officers all the way to the detectives, the prosecutor, there was no care to really for Amp and Suzanne and Angela to really like dig in and give them justice and make sure they're getting this right for these victims. That was never there, you know, so they just didn't get into all these details that we normally will see at a trial.
So let's get into some of these listener questions here. Elise has two questions, and the first one is, could the lower amount of cocaine in Amp's system be because he smoked first and the drug had already diminished in his system by the time he was shot?
No. So it's good. It's a really good question, but no, that's what the metabolite piece of this is what paints the whole picture. Because in order, and just to kind of review for people, so you smoke, snort, shoot cocaine, whatever form you put it into your body. It gets in and it immediately starts to process and those numbers start coming up in your blood. And then within from 1 to 5 minutes, I mean, almost immediately, your blood starts to process it. I've never done this drug. I don't know. But, you know, from what I understand from just people who I know who have, like, if you snort cocaine, you're feeling it right now. Mm-hmm. Well, that's because it's in your blood and you're processing it right now. As soon as that starts to happen, as soon as you're starting to get those effects, that's because your body's metabolizing it. And then those metabolites start showing up in your bloodstream. But the and then within like 90 minutes to, I'm trying to remember the range. I know average around 90 minutes, the cocaine is gone in and out of your blood. The high is over. You're done. There's no more cocaine in your blood. But the metabolites created from that process will stay in your blood and be detectable in your blood for like up to 2 days.
Okay.
So there's not a world where you could take it and peak, have it come down and still not have the metabolites in your blood. And 46 is a very low level of it. So to me, it was either a very small dose or it was like he was shot very quickly or in the process of smoking, which again, like I keep saying I don't want to jump the shark, but that's not the right term there.
I don't know what the term you're looking for is, but I don't think that was it.
I don't want to bury the lead is what I meant to say, but we got a good question about that.
Okay. So Elise's second question was there a pipe found at the scene? If Amp was holding it while he was shot, wouldn't have likely fallen and broken.
Good. We're getting right there. Good question. I did some research on that too. So we think of crack pipes as a glass pipe, like a flower. Mm-hmm. Like a glass floret or whatever. You can see them in like gas stations and stuff sometimes where people sell them. That is the most common way to smoke to smoke crack cocaine. It is not the only way. Because you're right, like if you drop it, you would expect that to have broken. Did the killer take it with? Because there's no pipe, there's no drugs, there's no baggies, there's nothing found on the scene. So yeah, but you would expect it to maybe drop. But also, it is also pretty common from what I was reading to use other like metal objects. What I'm picturing from a car antenna doesn't make sense to me, but they said people will use like car antennas to make pipes. They can pretty much make a pipe out of anything. So it doesn't have to be glass to begin with. But also if you go back to the crime scene episode where I went through Bertosi's testimony about the house, what you'll see is where Amp was sitting on that chair. There's a big fluffy rug right under him too. It almost looks like a bath mat rug, which is interesting because it's pink. So it's, I know it just looks out of place there. It's hard to tell because it's curled up. But point being, if you dropped a glass pipe on that, it wouldn't break. I don't think it would break.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah. But I like where you're, I like the thought process we're going through here.
So Kathy asks, is it possible that the lower level of cocaine in Amp system be the result of secondhand smoke?
Another good question, another thing caused me to research, and the short answer is no, absolutely not, can't be. And the reason, you know, I read some case studies about this, the levels, so there's always a level of drugs like, say, THC or cocaine or whatever it is, that anything above this level can't be explained by anything other than illicit use. So it can't be caused by passive use. In the case of cocaine, and specifically crack cocaine, studies were done where people were put into a room, like an enclosed room with no ventilation and exposed to like large volumes of it, the highest level of cocaine that they get, usually it was zero. The highest level of cocaine that you could get from that, from secondhand in a very tight and closed environment, is like 1 to 5 nanograms per milliliter. And understand, so we're several magnitudes of order away from where we're at. So the level AMP had was 46 micrograms per liter. If you convert that into nanograms per milliliter, it means he had 46,000 nanograms per milliliter.
Wow.
And the highest you could get from secondhand is 1 to 5.
That's really surprising me, because that was my first thought to piggyback off Kathy's question. And I didn't bring it up because I knew Kathy had the question. But I thought that as well. I thought maybe there was a possibility that with him just being in the room while they were smoking crack, that would be enough to get his levels elevated.
No, and that's what I was shocked it was so far away, because I was like, maybe it would be, because yeah, I had a former employer, somebody who was caught smoking marijuana on the job, and he tried to, it was secondhand in there. And I don't remember the numbers, but what I remember is like through like a union arbitration when the lawyers were involved and everything, is they were like, he's like, I didn't smoke. It was just secondhand because I was around somebody that did. And they like presented these studies through the arbitration where they're like, no, this is the highest level you could possibly get from passive use. You were 100 times over that. In AMP's case, he was like 40,000 times higher than that.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. So Rebecca has a question and a little bit of a theory to go behind it. I'm just going to read the whole thing that we can go through it. Rebecca says, is the working theory that the killers brought the crack, gave it to all three, and then killed them, then removed the crack pipe, lighter and everything else, and that we would expect to see at the scene? She says, I guess I struggle to see how realistic this is. Are killers who clearly intend to execute the three quickly and efficiently going to bother them with the crack and then tidy up afterwards?
So they didn't tidy up afterwards. It's a really good question. You're getting into kind of behavioral analysis, which any of you longtime listeners know, like, this is my favorite thing. When we get to this point, we still need more information to fully get there and create a profile. But this is what we know. So let's start there. What we know is that they hadn't smoked crack, snorted cocaine, did any drugs all day long, all night long. And we know that they all three did within 1 to probably 2 or 3 minutes of dying. So like we always look at, I always kind of liken conversations like this back to my arson investigation days. What I'm looking for is what changed. Like when I'm doing an interview with, like, I'm not expecting it. I don't think something is an arson. It's an accidental fire. We still have to determine the cause and origin of the fire. So I'm interviewing the homeowners and trying to figure out, okay, what changed? What changed about your routine? What was different right before this happened? You know, examples, you know, somebody has a car fire. I remember when I was at, it was a car in the parking lot of Walmart, and we're going through and I'm trying to trace, and I know the area. I can figure out the area where the fire started. And I'm like, hey, walk me through your day. What'd you do? It's like normal day, just everything. Well, detailed. I left here. I went there. And then they're like, then I went to Quick Lube. It wasn't Quick Lube, but like that. Got my oil changed, then I came here, and then my car caught on fire. And it's like, there it is. Like, that was the thing that changed. It was, and then as it turned out, we dig a little farther, we find some melted plastic, and they had forgot to put the oil cap back on, and it was spilled, you know, so something like that. I had a more complicated one, was really an interesting one. I actually talked about it on Jim Clemente's Best Case, Worst Case podcast one time, but it was a case of spontaneous combustion. But it was one of those, like, nothing made sense. Like, the point of origin of this fire was the middle of a stairwell. There was no heat source. There was nothing there. You're always looking for, is there an outlet that could have shorted out? Was there something? So we thought it was arson. We thought it was like, it didn't really look like a burn pattern, but clearly the fire started somewhere where fire shouldn't start. Didn't make any sense.
Yeah.
And I go, and I mean, they were ready to throw the cuffs on them. Because we work with the state police when we have cases like that, because it looked like there was an arson. And I'm going through my interview with them, and I have them walking me through the scene. Like, what'd you do? I went through, and it was at a Dairy Queen that had like an apartment above it that was used as offices. And they're like, you know, so we always come, and my husband decorates the cakes for the next day. I do all the dish rags. I do all the laundry from all the rags in the washcloths and stuff from the kitchen. And we just have this whole routine. We go through da 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 da. And as part of that conversation, she says, you know, so I put the stuff in the dryer. And he finished the cakes, and we were getting ready to leave on vacation. So we had to leave earlier than normal. So then I went over here to the dryer and I pulled the towels and stuff out and I put them in. And she, mind you, she doesn't know where the fire started.
Mm-hmm.
And she's like, and I threw them in a laundry basket. And then I always set them right here for the girl that comes in the morning to fold them and put them away. And she pointed right to where the fire started.
Oh, geez.
And I'm like, wait, so what, tell me what was different? Well, we were leaving early. So was the dryer done running? No, the dryer was still going. This is a long story, but I find it interesting. So hopefully you guys do too. So what it was, your dryer has a cool down cycle. So so when it's done drying everything off, then it turns the heating elements off and still tumbles things for a little bit to cool them off. In this case, she pulled them out before they were fully dry and before it cooled down. So then we go down to the kitchen and start looking around and like, hey, what are these used to, what are the rags used for? And she said, well, they just wipe up the griddles and, you know, oil and whatever stuff they can get out, wherever they got to wipe off. We look at the oil they use. It's all organic oil. Long story short, it was literally spontaneous. She put them a pile of rags that still had oil residue on them. They were still a little bit damp and still hot in a bundled up pile. And they literally spontaneously combusted. But again, so what changed? Let me jump back to our case now, right? Mm-hmm. So here, like what changed? Well, what changed is they were sitting there minding their own business. And then all of a sudden, they all smoke crack and then they're all also get shot. So like, I think it's, there's no question that those two events are tied together, them smoking and them getting shot. Well, they didn't shoot themselves. Someone shot them. They didn't have drugs before, or they weren't smoking drugs before. So likely the person that came with them shot them. So getting back to your question, is the working theory, I don't have a working theory yet, but I've got a hypothesis about it. And what I've started kind of processing is the fact that there's no drugs found there, there's no pipe found there, tells me that yes, the killer took them with them. So then what I'm looking for, rather than say that just seems unlikely, we kind of know that happened, right? Like they all smoked crack within a minute of dying, a couple minutes of dying, and there's no crack pipe there. So there's really no other explanation other than the killer took it with them. So instead of thinking that seems unlikely, I'm not even questioning if it's likely because it seems like it's an absolute or pretty damn close to an absolute. So now I'm thinking about what does that tell me about the offender? What it tells me about the offender is that they are calculated, they're organized. Even though the scene looks like chaos, they're organized enough and are criminally sophisticated enough to remove something that would have their fingerprints and likely their DNA on it when they left the scene. So yeah, it's more risk, right? They're staying there a little bit longer. And it's not because it is because that would tie them back to it, but I know that they had the mental capacity to know that if they come here, they see a crack pipe there on the ground, they test the crack pipe, they're going to find my DNA on it and they're going to get me. Mm-hmm. So I'm taking it with me, right?
So Brian in the chat literally just brought that up about having prints on the pipe from the killers.
Yeah, prints, or if they smoked off of it, DNA too. So and also that tells me we're probably dealing with somebody with a violent history. Mm-hmm. Because like this is an incredibly horrific, violent scene. Let's not forget there was an 18-month-old kid, baby, on the couch right there when they did this. Right? So this to me is not someone who just, you know, lived this perfectly, you know, nonviolent life, and this is the first time they ever did anything violent. That's not going to be the case, I don't think. It's going to be somebody with a violent past, a violent history, and someone who has probably been involved in violence connected to drugs because they thought they knew enough to know that the drug needed to come out. Now, the question is why, mm-hmm. right? So why give them the drugs? Was it, let's all smoke? And then somebody says something that pisses them off. I don't think so. They kill three people in front of an 18-month-old child. I think they went there with murder in mind. I also think that, and I don't think that we're talking about a dealer. I'm getting way ahead of ourselves, but just as I'm spitballing here, because that was a really good question. I don't think this is like the dealer that pops in and stands there with them. Again, I've never been a drug user, so I don't know. But it seems to me that from what I've heard from other people, because I've had a lot of conversations about this over the last couple of weeks, not super common to sit there and get high with whatever the substances you're using with your dealer.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's more likely someone that they were friendly with, someone they knew, and they're just, you know, they showed up, let's smoke. As soon as they were distracted, then they executed their plan, took the pipe, got out of there.
So part of the last thing that Rebecca had written is if the three of them were regular cocaine or crack users, the metabolites would be in their system, right? So right. We don't know what regular means realistically, right? But we know that it's about 2 days it stays in their system, give or take.
At least one day. So yeah. So all we can work with are the facts that we know, right? So what I can't say if they are regular users right now. Mm-hmm. You know, we're going to be getting into this victimology over these next couple weeks now, to try to answer some of these questions. But what I can say is none of them had used cocaine in any form within 24 hours of dying.
Okay. And that leads us into our next question from Sarah.
Before you do that, I'm sorry, I want to back up and say one more thing. Other than this one needle mark in Angela's arm, which again, so now we're talking at least 24 hours since they could have possibly used any cocaine, probably more.
Mm-hmm.
So because I didn't even know this, you can shoot up cocaine. There are people that will like dilute it with water and then inject it. Other than that, there's no evidence that they had any intravenous drug use of any kind either.
Okay.
Because there's not track marks, there's not multiple needle marks, none of that.
Hey everybody, Bob here. I'm interrupting this ad break to tell you how you can never have to hear another ad and take a huge step towards helping us continue our work all at the same time. As most of you know, I provide all investigative and advocacy services to the people and attorneys that we cover on the show completely free. Over the years, we provided hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of professional investigations to the wrongfully convicted, completely free of charge. And the reason that we're able to do that is in large part thanks to the support of listeners like you. Our Patreon community funds the overwhelming majority of our work, and I want to take this opportunity to ask and encourage you to join the club. The base level membership is just $5 a month. Now, while that's only a cup of coffee's worth out of your account, it makes all the difference in the world to us and the people that we work with. And for your $5 a month, you get a whole list of extra content, exclusive just for patrons. Every week, Janet, Zach, and I do an hour-long live stream just for our patrons. You also get an unedited video version of the Friday follow-up every week, a weekly pregame podcast that drops into your podcast feed. Patrons often get to participate in interviews that we do on the show live days or weeks before the rest of the audience gets to hear them. And of course, the best part, all of our content is completely ad-free for our patrons at the $5 a month level. Patreon really is the only way that we're able to keep doing this work. And it would mean the absolute world to me, Zach, Janet, and Erica if you'd consider joining if you're able to do so. Joining the Patreon community is super easy. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. Or you can go right to the episode description of this or any episode and just click the link. Thank you from the bottom of our hearts for your support. And now I'll return you to your regularly scheduled ads.
So this does lead into Sarah's question, which is, with what we know now, was there any historical use of cocaine or crack by these three? Or was this a new thing?
As of right now, I don't know. I mentioned a few weeks ago that I have the phone number for Anthony Amp's son.
Mm-hmm.
And it sounds like he's agreed to talk to me. I haven't reached out to him yet because I'm right now in conversations with Liz's daughter. And I don't want to get too many balls in the air. And we had already covered the ballpark crime scene. So I'm really kind of working on that. But my next step is to now talk to Amp. I'm hoping that he's willing to talk to me and share a little bit of it. Because I don't know the answer to that. But these are questions that we're hoping to get answered.
And Sarah's second question, sadly, I think I know the answer to this, is were the phones checked?
No, but also I don't know that there were any cell phones involved.
Okay. That's interesting because she notes that there feels like there would be some phone communication with the perpetrator.
Possibly, but remember, this is 2000. Mm-hmm. So there were cell phones, but they weren't like now where everybody's, you know, 10-year-old has a cell phone.
Yeah.
You know, they're like, I didn't have a cell phone did I? I guess I did have my first cell phone in 2000. I got my first one in 99. But not a lot of people had cell phones. And remember, to get you back into kind of the time frame, remember how Liz got a hold of whoever she was talking to. She paged them from a landline and they called her back on the landline.
Okay. And do we know if the landline was ever checked?
I haven't seen that. I'm not going to say no because I haven't been through enough to verify, but I've not seen any information about that. So no, I don't think so. But also remember, we have Larry, and it's hard to know what's true and what's not from Larry, but you know, he had said somebody had been there earlier in the night. And there was, you know, some kind of guy. Now that got warped into it was Chris Bynum there, even though he has no idea who Chris Bynum is.
Mm-hmm.
But if there was a conversation earlier in the night, there may not have been any phone conversation.
That's true. So we're going to move into the injuries a little bit. And this question is from Ken. It says, if I understood the injury to Amp's arm correctly, the entry wound was on the outside of the wrist and the exit wound was on the inside. My immediate reaction was, this means he was handing some item to someone else, or he put his empty hand up in front of his face to protect himself in a natural position, would be like you're doing a stop sign with your palm out, so the inner wrist would be exposed. But if you're passing something to someone with your hand closed, your outer wrist would be exposed. And I think this dovetails Bob's hypothesis of the shooting.
This was the one that I kept hinting at. Mm-hmm. Ken, it's a great idea, and I think Ken's on to something here. So again, if you haven't been to the website to look at the animations, it's worth looking at it. I don't think it is an odd, like, I don't think it's odd that someone would cover their face with their palms in before they get shot like that. Mm-hmm. If they're just kind of just, you know, not trying to stop the shot, but trying to protect their face. And of course, logic tells you you're not going to protect yourself from a gunshot with your hands, but instinct will still cause people to do that. It's very common. But when I read Ken's question there, I started thinking about it, going back to that model and looking, because, you know, Quentin, once he had the shots lined up, then it was like, okay, what could this mean? So, because obviously you see his right hand is up in that image too. Well, we don't know what his right hand was doing, but you know, we kind of were, it's like, okay, well, what if he was doing like this, you know, put his other hand up to kind of make it look like a realistic position. But if we couple it with the very low level of the cocaine in his system, which again, either means a very small hit or incomplete or just hit it, like took a puff, you know, inhaled and then was shot before the drug could fully hit him. What I thought of, and for those of you that are on YouTube watching this, from what Ken was saying, he was suggesting that maybe he was passing it to someone. But I think another possibility is he was in the process of smoking it. Remember, the shot goes into his neck, through his wrist, into his neck. And I'm just thinking from literally watching TV, so who knows? But like, I could see somebody sitting in a chair, maybe hunched over a little bit, and they hit it and just kind of like, you know, as the drug is entering their system, they just kind of, you know, they're still holding their, imagine still holding your left hand up in front of you, holding the pipe that you just took a drag off of, and then just kind of putting your head down, you know, for a second as it hits you, all of a sudden you could see how that would line up with the shot going through the wrist into the neck. And truthfully, based on what Ken said, I think that's very likely what happened. Again, when you couple it with that low level, if he just hit it, but that what that would also indicate was that Amp was shot first, and someone, I don't remember who, but our first round going through this scene in Bertosi's testimony, you know, somebody suggested in our follow-up, or maybe I don't remember if it made the air or not, that they would think that Amp would have been the first target because he would have been the biggest threat.
That's what I would think, is you would take out the most likely threat first.
Right. And so now we look at this low level compared to the other two. That shot, because I'm fairly certain that shot did go through his wrist into his neck. And, you know, again, we found the extra round that could account for the one that went through Suzanne's arm. But with Amp, it seems pretty clear that's what happened. And so you could see, you know, the pipe gets passed to Angela and Suzanne. They hit it, they grab it, hand it to Amp. He takes a drag, puts his head down, and bam, first shot to him. And then he gets up, and then another shot to him, and then shoot the girl. Or, you know, one offender is shooting Amp with those two shots, and then the other one fires the six shots at the two women on the ground. So, yeah, that's just, I think we're getting the what I'm really happy with where we've gotten so far is I think we're getting closer to figuring out what happened here, because we can't do any kind of real behavioral analysis. We can't do, you know, as I said at the beginning of this episode, we can't begin to figure out the who until we know the what and the how mm-hmm. happened. And I think we're getting closer to that.
And yeah, understanding that crime scene is extremely important.
Mm-hmm.
So this next part is from Liz. Liz is curious if we have any more detail about the stomach contents besides the gray tan liquid. This seems extremely vague, and she notes that we've had much more detailed descriptions in other cases. She wants to know if there's any way from what we have to determine what they've actually eaten.
Unfortunately, no. And you're right. Again, this autopsy is not detailed. Now, it says semi-liquid. Like the gray tan part of it, just so you know, is common. Like I have Dr. Spitz's medical legal textbook out here, and you know, I looked in there, like that's a very, like a semi-liquid gray tan fluid is just like medical speak for partially digested food within probably an hour to hour and a half of eating. Like that's what that tells you. Now, if you go back to like Jim Melgar's autopsy mm-hmm. in the Sandy Men season 6, you know, there was like, they were breaking down to the volume that was in there, how much of it was solid, what color the actual chunks of food were, all this detail that we had in his autopsy compared to this one where we just get semi-liquid gray tan fluid. So unfortunately, no, we don't have any more information than that. And without a better description and possibly even photos, there's just no way to know.
And does that give us any sort of timeline on when they ate?
It does. It tells us that they ate within 2 hours, likely closer, based on, and it's hard to tell because the description is so vague,
mm-hmm.
but based on what I'm reading from the textbook, it tells you that probably, you know, rough estimate around an hour before they were killed, they ate something. Okay. If it's still semi-liquid, it's still gray tan, generally that's around an hour, maybe an hour and a half, closer, you know, could be as early as 30 to 45 minutes. There's a lot of factors in there too. What kind of food? Was it high in protein? Was it high in carbohydrates? What's their metabolism? You know, there's a whole lot of different factors that go into that. So it's not like you can really pin it down. And like I said in the episode, in this case, it doesn't really matter.
Yeah, with them being home.
Yeah, they're home, doesn't matter. In the ball field with Liz and Sheila, it does matter. Because, and again, them eating doesn't matter, but them eating, if Sheila ate after leaving Michelle's house, then that's a location. That's another stop. That's another potential place to come into contact with the offender that killed them.
So this is our last question. It's from Richard. And it says, now that we've looked at both crime scenes, do you think it's still possible that they are connected? And Marcia has similar thoughts. She says, I don't think they're connected. I mean, how and why?
Great questions. Don't have the answers. So is the theory they're connected? I don't know. If I'm looking at the evidence that we have in front of us right now, I would not look at, in isolation, I would not look at these two crime scenes and say, yes, they're connected. Say that because so far, the only thing that could possibly connect them based on what we have so far is the shot to Sheila's head.
Okay.
That's it. Now I'm second guessing myself. We didn't have any confirmed 38 caliber from the first one, did we?
I do not believe so. I feel like there was something that was measured at 3/8 of an inch, but I feel like there was.
It was I think it was one of the shots to Liz. That's right. Because the one to Sheila is the one that passed through something else and it broke up. It was completely broken up. Mm-hmm. Now, when we get into the forensics in the firearms examiner, we may find out there's more to it. But, you know, we have the shot through Liz's chest. We have no idea what caliber that was.
Mm-hmm.
No clue. The shot to Sheila's head, based on what we know so far, we don't know what caliber that was. It was you got one shot that's the same caliber. Other than that, two very different crime scenes. Again, though, it does. So I'm punting because I just don't know the answer yet. So for Marcia, no, I'm not ready to say they're not connected because I don't have any evidence they're not, but I don't have any evidence they are either. At this point. So what we're looking for in the victimology piece of it, and as we dig deeper, is to find out, is there a connection between the victims? Because I do believe that the ball field crime scene is indicative of them concealing the crimes to get temporary concealment, to give them time to do something and going to get rid of witnesses could be that something.
Okay.
You know, so if we find evidence that the two from the ball field had been to the house that night, then we're on to something. Then there's obviously that's too much of a coincidence, first of all. And also, that would make sense for why they would go conceal those bodies to give them enough time to go get rid of those witnesses.
That's really interesting. So with that being said, what do we have coming up this week?
So this week, we should have, hopefully, on this Sunday, we're going to hear from Liz's daughter. So I've texted with her quite a bit. I had a nice long conversation with her over the phone last week. And we did have an interview scheduled for Sunday, but she had some stuff come up. She wasn't able to do it. So on Thursday, so the day before you're hearing this episode, we're scheduled to record an interview with her where we're going to get into all as much of Liz's victimology as we possibly can. We're going to learn about Liz as a person, not just as a victim. And also talk a little bit about like what this process was like with Tasha, that's Liz's daughter, and her interactions with police and what that process was like as well. So that's what's coming up on Sunday. Unless something else comes up with schedule, and then at which point I'll just be scrambling on Friday to come up with something. but hopefully that's what we'll be hearing on Sunday. As of right now, that is the plan. So make sure you tune in on Sunday so we can get a little bit more information to start doing a better job of building out the picture, figuring out what happened here. And then we'll talk to you guys next week.
Bye, guys.
Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production, co-written and produced by Erica Bergenham. Music created and composed by Caden Ladislaw. Follow-up episodes are co-hosted by Janet Varney and Zach Weaver. Our logo font was created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. Our website is created, managed, and maintained by Katie Ross of createdintandem.com. Thank you to our volunteer transcription team, Erica Cantor, Kathy McElhaney, Courtney Wimberly, Kaywood Yomnick, Danielle Rohr, Jennifer Athey, and Caroline Dwyer. Truth and Justice provides all investigative and advocacy work for the wrongfully convicted completely free of charge. We're able to do that in large part thanks to you, our listeners, through your generous pledges on Patreon. Patreon accounts for the overwhelming majority of our funding. The number one way you can support our work is to become a patron at patreon.com/truthandjustice. For just $5 a month, you'll get all episodes ad-free, a bonus pregame episode every Wednesday, and also a video version of the Friday follow-ups exclusive to our patrons. Patrons also get to participate and join the chat live in many of our interviews and get early access to much of our content. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. It doesn't cost you a penny and goes a long way towards making the show more visible. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. You can always keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the official Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. You can also connect with us on social media platform X @truthjusticepod. And to follow our personal accounts on social media, I can be found at Bob Ruff Truth. Janet can be found at Janet Varney, and Zach is at Z to the Q. However you do it, stay engaged and stay in touch. But as for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
I'm Zach Weaver.
And I'm Janet Varney.
And this has been Truth and Justice.